variety of things. You've probably been in some of the other parks, and you've noticed that there may be a wilderness area, a mountain area, or a specific type of area. Well, Acadia has tremendous variety of things to offer you folks. There's naturally the seashore, which is unique to Acadia, and there are also many inland areas which are certainly worth your exploring. And by all means, if you can, put it into your schedule, go out with a naturalist on some of the walks and some of the hikes and see what's here in the park. And get away from your automobile. We have almost 200 miles of trails in this park, and we urge everyone to get out and use them. And ask your questions to the naturalist and all the rangers so you better understand what you're seeing. Don't try to fit in everything by any means. The tremendous variety of things we have, it can interest a few people as a whole, but there's probably something here that interests you in particular. So seek this one thing out and go after it. Don't try to fit it all in. You just can't do it. This park has too much to offer, and if you try to fit too many things in, you'll just jam up your schedule and you won't really appreciate what you're seeing. And if you do see as many things you think you want to see for a while, then you want to relax, there are several areas in the park where you can do this. Just lay on the beach for a day and take it easy and don't worry about trying to learn everything that the park has to offer. Now, for those of you who don't live too far away from Acadia, the park is open all year round, and it's a very interesting place to see in the winter. The park is still here, but it takes on a completely different pattern. It looks altogether different. It is cold. I will not try to give you any false impressions about the weather up here. It does get quite cold, but it's extremely beautiful to see this park in the wintertime. And believe me, you won't have any trouble getting a campsite at Black Woods around the middle of January or February. And Black Woods is open, and you are welcome to use the campground during this time of the year. So if you can fit it in during the winter, come on up and by all means, just see how different an area can be between summer and winter. You'll certainly enjoy it. There's another thing which adds a lot of charm to Acadia. It's not Acadia actually, it's the surrounding areas. The people who live in the private areas of Acadia have added a lot of charm to this island as a whole. The people who live up here work hard for a living, and they haven't progressed as fast as a lot of other parts of the country in some ways. In other ways, they're way ahead of the rest of the country. But people live rather slow up here. They do work quite hard. They enjoy life, and they do a lot of things today just as they were done many years ago. So things haven't changed too much, and you can certainly enjoy a day of just roaming around the island away from parkland over on the western side of the island and see some of the small lobstering villages and the fishing villages and really take in their charm and enjoy the beauty of them. You'll find a lot of things that are still done up around here which is long forgotten about in other parts of the country. So whatever season you come to Acadia, I'll guarantee you'll enjoy it. Very interesting place to see and visit. Now there's one thing that you always see when you come to Acadia, and these are the gulls. This is what we're going to talk about tonight. The seagulls that inhabit our coastlines, not just in Acadia, but all down the New England coast. These birds are very interesting. It's unfortunate that so many of us just take them for granted. If we see the ocean, we just expect to hear a little bit of surf come rolling in and to hear and see some gulls. But that's about it for most of us. We don't really take the time to stop and enjoy these birds. And we don't take the time to stop and enjoy a lot of things in nature, which offer tremendously interesting pastimes if you just want to relax now and then, forget about our troubles, and watch nature in action. And the gulls are by all means one of these things that we just take for granted. The soaring of a gull is a very interesting thing to watch. If you ever do take the time to sit down and watch these birds, keep your eye on their head while they're soaring around. That head doesn't miss a trick. They're always looking for something to eat, always bobbing that head around and picking out every interesting little particle along the coastline. The call of the gull is another thing that we often take for granted, but every call that the gull makes means something, and the gull is not always making the same sound. They're giving a message to other gulls in the area. They're not just making their sound so that people can enjoy listening to them by any means. Well, if we're going to talk about gulls, the first thing we have to do is to be able to identify the gulls. Now we have several types right here. The most common one by far is the herring gull. This is the one with the gray breast and the white breast and the white head and the gray wings. The next most common one is the great blackback gull, has similar markings to the herring gull, only they have black wings and they're a little bit larger than the herring gull. But the herring gull is by far the most common one, and this is the one we want to concentrate mostly on right tonight. Now, if you're interested in determining the sex of one of these birds, there are a few tricky ways you can do it. To begin with, the male and female have identical plumage patterns. You can't just look at the color of a gull and know if it's a male or a female. The males are larger than the females. But we have a problem here already. A large female can be larger than a small male. But for some reason, when a pair of gulls forms, when two gulls mate off, a male and a female, the male is always larger than the female within the pair. So if you do see a pair of gulls, you can easily tell the male from the female just because the male will be larger. There is one little trick you can use by spotting these birds out in the field, and this is to look at the forehead. The forehead on the feet on the male is rather flat, and it just tapers down gradually and blends in as part of the beak. Now the female, you just have to look a little bit closer, and the forehead is sharper. It drops down rather briskly and just does not blend in as smoothly with the beak. Now there's another little problem you're going to run into trying to identify gulls. You're going to see some brown ones, mottled brown, spotted gulls. Now these are actually the same species. They're the herring gulls and the great blackback gulls, but they're immature birds. They haven't reached maturity. They don't have the full adult plumage. The reason you see so many of these is that it takes 4 years for a gull to lose its immature mottled brown plumage and gain its complete adult plumage. And it's at this time that it reaches sexual maturity and starts to reproduce and really make its impression on the ecosystem of our coastline. When the birds are first born, when they hatch out of the egg, and for about 2 months after hatching out of the egg, they have what's called a cryptic coloration, sort of a camouflage pattern that just allows them to blend in with their environment. This protects them from predators mainly. And a lot of nature's creatures go through this stage. The spots on a fawn deer serve the similar function. It just allows the animal to blend in very well with its surroundings. And this is what the cryptic coloration of the gull chick is for also. Now this works very well. If you can't find the little gull chick in this picture, come up and bother me after the program and I'll put the picture back up there so you can really hunt and seek him out. He is in there, I'll guarantee you, but he's quite hard to see. This just proves to you that this cryptic pattern certainly does work. Now after the gulls are ready to leave the nest at the age of 2 months, they lose their cryptic coloration and they take on the mottled brown immature plumage. And they will keep forms of this plumage until they're just about 4 years old. Gradually, every season, they'll lose a little more of the brown and take on some more of the adult plumage until eventually they do emerge as full adults. Now, it's during this time that they're changing their patterns that we really want to think about as we're talking about gulls tonight. Now, we'll get into this a little bit later, but the fact that the survival rate of these birds in this stage is a very important thing along our coastal ecosystem. And this is what I want to try to impress upon you folks before you leave tonight. So when the bird finally emerges into the adult plumage, he's 4 years old, and this is when he's really starting to make his mark on the coastal ecosystem. Now, another thing that is common about these birds is their sound, their calls. We hear gulls a lot. But once again, we don't take much time to sit down and really listen to the sounds the birds are making. And every bird certainly does have a meaning. Now, if you'd been up here about 3 months ago, you would have heard a tremendous amount of noise coming from these birds because this is when they were going through their mating routine and their courtship displays. And this is when most birds are the noisiest during the mating season. Right now, about the most common sound you'll hear from a gull is a call which tells other gulls to stay away from the particular bird's feeding territory. Each adult bird stakes out a little area where it does its feeding and it keeps the other birds away, the other gulls away, simply by giving a call. And this call is a means of threat. It prevents a lot of fighting, therefore it prevents the waste of a lot of energy. If one bird simply knows that it better stay away from a given area because it's already inhabited by a gull which is feeding in that area, it will usually stay away from the area, and for this reason it won't result in a fight, and there will be a conservation of energy. However, occasionally a brave soul will try to wander in and take a feeding territory from one that has already established the territory, and usually, or almost always, a fight will ensue and the strongest bird will emerge as the champion and the other one will be driven off from the feeding territory. So this is why the gulls are making their calls now. Most of their calls now is just to warn other birds to stay away. Well, this sound has been becoming much more common along the New England coast during the past 50 or 60 years. It's becoming more common because there are more gulls. Excuse me. Now, a lot of people were interested in just what effect the increased population of gulls was having on the whole coastal ecosystem. If indeed there was such an increase in the number of these birds, what effect it was having, and just how rapidly the numbers were increasing. So the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Maine Fish and Game Commission, the Audubon Society, and a few other groups, for the past 30 or 40 years, have been doing some experimental work to determine just how serious the increase may be and what effect it will have in the long run. Several techniques have been used to study the growth in the population of the gulls. One of the most common is the cannon net method. An area is chosen where the gulls are known to frequent. A net is laid out on the ground near where these birds will come in to feed. The net is attached at several points to a line, and these lines in turn are attached to small cannons. When the birds come in a flock and settle down, the cannons are fired simultaneously out over the flock. And then when the net settles down, you have yourself quite a mess there to sort out and decide just what you're going to do with it. A lot of data is taken on the birds. The age of the bird, the approximate age, the sex, where they were taken, the date of capture. All this material is kept on file at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service banding office in Laurel, Maryland. And then the birds are banded, an aluminum numbered band is placed on the left leg of each bird. This number is very carefully recorded, and the intention is that someday some of these birds will be recovered, or at least the band will be recovered, along with the information as to where the bird was taken and when it was taken, and other important information. And a lot of facts have been learned from the few birds that have been returned. By far, most of the banded birds are never seen again. This is done with all species of birds, but we're talking about gulls in particular tonight. It has been done with many types of birds, and an interesting fact which has been learned about gulls from the recovery of just one band was a good estimate of how old a gull will live. An individual was fortunate enough to find a black-backed gull floating in Lake Superior a few years ago that had been banded on Matinicus Island right here on the coast of Maine 33 years before it was found in Lake Superior. Now, I don't think any ornithologist would have made the bold statement that a gull could live to be 33 years old before this band had been recovered. But it was just fortunate that this one bird was found that had lived this long. So it's known now that gulls can live at least this long, possibly longer. This is definitely an isolated case. The average age is about 12 to 15 years. But this is just one of the facts that can be learned from banding. By far, the more important information which is gained from this banding program is the long-range effect that the movement of these birds is having on the whole part of the northeastern United States. And the numbers of band which are collected as groups and returned, and the information which is correlated with what was taken when the birds were first banded. Well, some of the facts that have been learned about gulls just from this banding program is that the population is very definitely increasing. In fact, the population has been doubling on the New England coast every 12 to 15 years for the past 50 years. Now, this is a tremendous increase for a population of anything to double every 12 to 15 years. Now, usually, there's a good reason if something is going haywire in nature. And it's been found from past experience that one of the main causes of things to go haywire in nature is man. And sure enough, man is the culprit again right here in the gull situation. What is happening is that the immature birds, we mentioned earlier, are being allowed to survive through the winters because man is feeding them through the winters. Under natural conditions, these birds would have to go out and compete with adult birds which had already established feeding territories, and if they were not fortunate enough to outsmart and outmaneuver an adult bird from its feeding territory, it would simply starve to death during the winter. However, what is happening is that these immature birds are simply ending up in dumps and food processing waste areas, and they're getting enough food to get them through the winter. And they're not living a natural life. They're living an unnatural life because man is feeding them in an unnatural way. In fact, only 12% of our gulls make what you might call an honest gull's living through the winter. This means that 88 out of every 100 gulls, on the average, are finding a food supply that man is leaving around so that they can get through their winters. And it's when these birds are reaching maturity and reaching sexual age, when they can start to reproduce, this is when the dangerous situation is evolving, which we'll see as we go on. Now, the birds are very well adapted to taking advantage of man's excess food supply. Now, why can't other birds do this? Why can't the other shorebirds, why aren't they increasing in numbers because man is leaving food around? Now, the reason is that these birds are very adaptable. And in this way, they're very much like man. Man is a very adaptable animal. How many animals can you think of that can swim and run and climb trees? You can't think of very many, but man certainly is one of them. Man has many physical abilities collectively that other animals don't have. Man can also eat quite a variety of foods. We're not confined to eating vegetation or meat. We can eat both. Now, the gull is very similar. He is also very unspecialized and very adaptable. The beak of the gull can be used in many different ways. They can dig animals out of the sand. They can crack open shells. They can use these beaks to pick up fish when they dive into the water after them. Tremendous amounts of ways the gull can use this beak. The feet, this is another thing which is adaptable. These feet can hold food. Most webbed feet can't. Most webbed-footed animals cannot, or birds cannot grasp food, but the gull can. Nico Ten Bergen, a gentleman from the Netherlands who probably knows more about gulls than any other man alive, has observed this very strange population of herring gulls over in the Netherlands, which goes to offshore islands to breed, which is very natural, but these birds have adapted to a very terrestrial means of getting their food. They use these feet to get earthworms out of the ground. Well, the way they do this, he calls it paddling. The birds will just stomp their feet up and down out in a meadow. And this sends minor shock waves through the ground, which earthworms mistake for moles coming under the ground after them. When an earthworm hears a mole coming, they usually panic and flee to the surface of the ground. Well, what happens when the gull is paddling his feet? The earthworm flees to the surface of the ground, and there's the gull waiting there to snatch him up. And this is just one way that this bird is not specialized to any one type of job. Very, very adaptable. And this is why these birds are able to capitalize on man's waste food that he's leaving lying around. Another specialty of the gulls is his flight pattern. The gull is not confined to any one type of flight. These birds are very good flyers. They can dive, they can glide, they can do many different types of flight maneuvers. Most birds are confined to just one type. These birds are not great distance flyers, but they can fly distances if they want to. There are many gulls which follow the Blue Nose Ferry from Bar Harbor to Yarmouth, Nova Scotia every day because they've learned that this is the way to get food. This is about a 100-mile trip one way, but most gulls only fly about 12 to 15 miles out to sea. However, a few of these birds have learned that by following the Blue Nose, they can get a food supply, but the important fact is that they have the ability to do this, whereas a lot of other birds simply don't have the ability. So when the gull is ready to get his food, he's not too fussy about how he's going to get it or what it's going to be when he does get it. I can't think of anything that gulls won't eat. Now, one woman a few weeks ago told me that she'd been over at Skudik and she could not get a gull to eat cantaloupe. Now, I haven't seen this in the literature anywhere, but it could be true that gulls won't eat cantaloupe. I haven't checked it out myself too carefully, but it is a possibility. But almost everything else except cantaloupe, gulls can't eat. Well, the danger which is being introduced by the increasing number of gulls is happening on the nesting colonies. These birds nest on offshore islands, and when they do decide to nest on an island, they will just about completely take the island over and inhabit it completely. Almost every square foot of it will be inhabited by gulls. These birds pick out a certain area, a certain sized area for their nest, and they'll drive the other gulls away from this area. But the fact is that by the time there are enough gulls around that want a small area, that in a very short time, all the area on a given island will be taken by the gulls. These are very interesting places to visit. A good place to wear a raincoat, even when the sun's shining. And this reminds me of a little story. A man and his wife were vacationing one summer on the coastline, and one evening they took a walk down on the beach. Well, the gentleman happened to be bald-headed. And just as soon as they left the cabin, a gull flew over, and you can imagine what happened. Well, the woman looked over at her husband and says, "Oh, Henry, let me run up quickly to the cottage and get you some toilet paper." Well, Henry looked over at his wife and says, "Oh, don't worry, dear. By the time you get back, that gull will probably be about 5 miles from here." When gulls build their nest, they almost always look for something vertical, which they can build it right beside. This is one of the few general rules you can make about gulls. You cannot make many general rules because there are usually exceptions to every rule you make because of their very unique adaptability. But in general, they will build their nest next to something vertical. Just why they do this is not really known. It's probably protection from the wind or protection from the sun, or maybe they figure that this allows the nest to be a little better hidden from predators. But this is one common habit they have, to build a nest next to something vertical. The three eggs are laid in a small depression which is filled with sticks. It's not a very complicated arrangement, but this is all there is to the nest. The red spot you see up there on the beak of that black-backed gull plays a very important part in the life of the chick. This spot is used by the chick to get fed. Chick gulls eat regurgitated food from the adults. The adults go out into the ocean and they gorge themselves with a certain type of food, and then they come back to the nest and they regurgitate food which the chick gull then eats. Well, nature has not taught the adult bird that it's supposed to do this. Nature has taught the bird to go out and overfeed itself and come back to the nest, but nature forgot to tell the adult gull that it's supposed to regurgitate some food so the chick can eat. Well, there's a strange habit which is followed by all young chick gulls, and that is that they will peck at anything red. A red stick, if it's placed down near a young chick gull, the young chick will just peck away at it as hard as he can. Well, what happens now is that the adult bird flies into the nest with a meal for the young bird. The young bird sees that red spot and starts pecking at it. Well, this is the signal to the adult bird that it's supposed to regurgitate food. It does not regurgitate food because the chick is there hungry. It regurgitates food because something is pecking at the red spot on its beak. And this is one of the strange ways that nature works in its animal behavior patterns, but this is the vital function of this red spot. It's important, very important to the young bird. The gulls always lay three eggs in a clutch. Chickens give us so many eggs because every day the farmer takes the egg away, the chicken comes back the next day and sees that it doesn't have a nest started, so it'll lay another egg. And this will go on, and some chickens have been known to lay an egg a day, almost every day for a whole year. Well, gulls won't do this. They're called determinant egg layers, which means that they'll only lay three eggs at a time and no more. Until about 2 weeks later, they will be able to lay three more eggs, but this is it. This is the size of the clutch. And when these eggs start to hatch out, the young chicks start many, many difficult problems in life which they have to overcome. One of the first ones is to break through that shell. That shell is very strong, it's very thick. Now some of these birds will start pecking through the shell and it'll be 3 days before they get out. By this time they're quite weak, they have to be fed immediately. So for this reason they're immediately facing some dangers of nature. If they're not fed immediately, they may starve to death. If one bird takes a little too long to get out of the shell, the other birds come out a day or two earlier, the other birds may be well ahead of the third bird, which had more difficulty getting out of the shell, and this bird is probably doomed. In fact, only one out of every three gull eggs that ever hatch reach it to the fledging stage. During the first 2 months of life, two out of every three chick gulls die for one reason or another. The weather is probably the most serious problem these birds face. A good storm can wash a whole colony right into the ocean. A very hot day may bake the eggs if they're not protected. A chill in the air may have a similar effect if the eggs are not protected. So what the dangers that these birds face are many by far. But the reason we're getting so many gulls along our coastline is that more birds are reaching maturity, therefore more are reaching sexual maturity after they leave the nest, and therefore more birds are around each year to establish nesting sites. And this is where the danger is coming in. Another problem, which is man-made, is that a lot of gull nests used to be preyed on by foxes. But man started having chickens out in the fields. The fox likes chickens also. When the fox was killing off the farmer's chickens, the farmer had to kill off the fox. And for this reason, a lot of gull nests were allowed to survive, which under natural conditions wouldn't have. So this is another way that man is allowing more gulls to survive. Well, just what effect is this having, this increased population of gulls on our whole coastline? Well, the problem is coming with the competition for nesting sites for the other types of birds. More gulls are leaving the nest every year. More gulls are reaching maturity. This means at maturity, more gulls are around every year to start nesting. And these birds are very aggressive nesters. They nest early in the season, and they will drive other birds away from the nesting colonies. Now the danger is coming to the many other types of birds which also use the nesting colonies. The double-crested cormorant is a very common bird we see around here. Looks something like a duck with a long neck and very clumsy flyers. These birds are also competing for nesting space with the gulls. Granted, only a mother could love this little chick, but who is to say how important the cormorant really is? We have too many examples of how offsetting nature in one way has caused chain reactions both up and down the food chain, which over a long period of time have very far-reaching detrimental effects. Another bird which faces the same problem is the common tern, another bird which likes to nest on the nesting colonies that the gulls prefer also. Matinicus rock is a good example of how the tern is in danger from the gulls. Several years ago, about 15 years ago, there were 4,000 tern nests on Matinicus rock. Now there are only about 800 because the gulls are driving the terns away. And another bird which has sparked more interest than the other two is the eider duck. This duck means an economic resource for the state of Maine because it's a good hunting bird. Years ago, these birds were shot off in great numbers for their down, a very highly prized down, which was used to fill pillows and mattresses and similar things. Well, these birds were shot almost into extinction along the Maine coast, and this practice was stopped. And since then, the birds have been making a pretty good comeback, and now it's found that these birds are good hunting. They taste good, it's good sport to hunt them, and for this reason, the state of Maine sees an economic resource. People will come to the state of Maine to hunt the eider ducks, so a lot of research is being done by the state of Maine to see just how the eider ducks are reproducing and how they're making it through the chain of life also out on our coastline. Well, it's been found that the gull is their number one problem, and this is why we're learning so much about gulls. This is the handsome male of the eider duck. They only keep this plumage for about 2 weeks out of the whole year when they're mating, and then they lose this plumage and they go into a plumage which is very similar to the female. The nest of the eider duck is preyed on somewhat by gulls, but the most dangerous situation is when these birds are ready to leave the nest and go down to the water. just two days after the ducklings hatch, they will go down into the water. They'll group together, and they'll be taken down by a number of females, and if one of those females just makes a mistake and leaves a few ducklings unguarded, the gulls are right there ready to snap them up. And just one swallow, and there goes one little eider duckling. These gulls are very predacious. But by far the most serious problem is in the competition for nesting sites. The nests are very well hidden, so the gulls don't prey on the individual nest very much. But the fact that the eider ducks can't find nesting sites is the problem. Another bird, which is in the very same situation and maybe more serious than any of the others along the main coast, is a very interesting little puffin. Looks something like a little chicken trying to eat a lobster claw. Well, these birds are very interesting. This is about the southern limit of their range. Matinicus Rock is the only sizable colony anywhere on the Atlantic coast of the United States. These birds are wing swimmers. They swim with their wings. They actually fly under the water. Well, Matinicus Rock, the colony of puffins is being threatened by the gulls on Matinicus Rock. And if the gulls continue to push the puffins right into the sea, it won't be long, and there won't be any puffins nesting anywhere on the east coast of the United States. So this is the seriousness of this problem, which is arising simply from the gull situation. Now, if you have become interested in gulls and you want to look at them while you're here at Acadia, there's just a couple that you'll get confused with. You'll see one flying around with a black head and a red beak. This is a laughing gull, not nearly as common as the other two, but you may see them, especially in around some of the harbors. If you come up in the wintertime, you may see the Iceland gull or many different types of gulls which breed much further north of us and spend their winters along our coastline. But by far the most important one and the most interesting one immediately is the little herring gull chick with all his very special adaptations and his unspecialized ability to make his way through the world. Now, the far-reaching effects of the gull problem is not really known yet, but there certainly is a problem. And it's quite a serious problem to try to solve, because by no means are gulls all bad. They are very much needed. I wouldn't like to see a coastline without any gulls around. These are probably the best garbage men in the world. They're very efficient at keeping our coastlines clean. So the problem with trying to control the numbers of gulls is to get that surplus which is competing against other birds on the nesting islands along our coastline. I hope that you'll take a little different look at gulls now than you see one out on the coastline and take some time to watch them and see some of their very strange habits and listen to some of their calls. You may not be interested in the puffin colony along our coastline. You may wonder why we care about gulls at all, why we're studying them. Well, this may have a much further reaching effect than you may think. Just because you're not interested in the puffin colony doesn't mean that there's a very good lesson here for us to learn from the gulls. I mentioned several times how very similar gulls are to man because of their physical ability.